Welcome to Survival Mode Disrupted, the podcast for those who are done performing, done people pleasing, and done living life on autopilot. I'm your host, Leticia, the Survival Mode Disruptor, and this is where we create disruptive, unapologetic transformations for those who are ready to exit survival mode and reclaim their power. Every episode is your permission slip to burn the rule book, break the cycle, and finally build a life that feels like yours. So let's disrupt everything that's holding you back and start living life on your own terms. Welcome to Survival Mode Disrupted. This is your trigger warning. This podcast contains unfiltered conversations about trauma, abuse, and survival. Discretion is advised. This is not therapy or medical advice, just real people sharing real stories. So please take care of yourself and pause if you need to. If this conversation hits home, grab the book Survival Mode Exit Plan, your raw, unapologetic blueprint to break free. Available now by scanning the QR code or clicking the link in the comments. Hello, 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 and welcome back to another episode of Survival Mode Disrupted. I'm your host, Leticia, the Survival Mode Disruptor, and today we have Martin. Martin, why don't you introduce yourself?
Hi, I'm Martin. I'm 61. Just recently retired in December, took early retirement, partially on health grounds, and I'm also a podcaster. I started podcasting in December.
Yeah, wonderful world of podcasting. So, Martin, tell us about your journey to survival mode.
Right, it really begins with 2020, when during the pandemic, when that started at the beginning of 2020. Then, like everybody else, we had some time. We had to work from home a little bit for quite a while. And we were all being very cautious as best we could. And then it eased off a bit. And then it came back again later in the year. And I can remember specifically, it was right at the end of October when there was going to be another lockdown coming in, because there was what they referred to it as the Kent strain at the time. It hit very, very heavy right in the locality where I'm down in southeast Kent. And I can remember, my wife had a cold the week before, and she was coughing, sputtering a little bit. But we were checking on there weren't all the other symptoms, and I started to get a bit of a cold as well. What I thought was a bit of a cold, and my wife kept on saying to me, "Oh, don't be so silly. There's nothing wrong with you. You've just got a cold." So I had to go into work on a Thursday, and then I was having the week off the week after. So anyway, basically, I went into work with a bit of a cough and a splutter, but took the temperature and that was fine. Everything was all right. So I thought, I'm okay to work here. Then over the weekend, I got gradually more unwell. I felt like a real nasty bout of flu. Getting into by the Tuesday the following week, by that time, I'd then gone down and got a test. I'd gone to one of the testing areas and I came up positive. By this time, I was feeling really, really unwell. I wasn't eating. I was feeling not able to sleep properly. So basically, I called 111, they sent an ambulance came, and they took me into hospital. And that was my first experience, actually, of ever being in hospital in all my life. I'd never been to hospital. So I'd gone to hospital, no visitors, and it was chaos. I describe it as almost as if you're on the front line of the First World War kind of thing. There was people running around all over the place. I was put into a room with about four or five other beds. And over the 8 days I was in hospital, I think six people died in that one room. So I thought, the first night, I thought, this is it. I'm finished. I'm done. I'm going to lose my life. And I was terrified. The nurses kept on coming in with concerned looking faces, looking at, because my heart was going really, really fast, about 200 beats a minute. I wasn't in any pain, physical pain. But I felt sick and obviously like really clammy with everything else. So got through that, eventually got through that, managed to survive, but terrible feelings of survival guilt afterwards, sort of coming home. And I had to, would you believe, I had to learn to walk again. I've only been in bed for a few days, but they were saying to me, right, okay, we're going to do some physiotherapy because you're going to need to learn to walk. And I'm like, oh, don't be stupid. I can walk. I sat up in the bed, went really, really dizzy, and then realized I couldn't stand. So it took a few days for that to come back. So I was with a walking stick when I first got home. It was then a case of just recovering slowly and then working. And having told work what had happened when I first got the confirmation of being positive for COVID. And then I didn't hear anything from work, anybody from work. There was no card sent or anything like that. Didn't hear from anybody. My way of trying to cope with the trauma of what happened was I started to journal it, started to write down what happened. And I kept contact when I was in hospital. My only way to contact people was via Facebook and giving people updates as to what was going on and how I felt and so on. And I just wanted to document the journey and put it out there. The next thing that happened was one of the senior people from where I worked openly attacked me on Facebook. Yeah, every time I tell people this, that the face you've made there, everybody I tell, they did what? He did. And this is a guy that I knew really well and considered to be quite a close friend, as it happened. But he just put loads of really nasty remarks. And I said to him, well, you know, I'm offended. My wife's offended. My family offended. My wife's offended. I'm offended. Can you withdraw those remarks? He carried on. He kept on sending for, it became a sort of messenger backwards and forwards to the point where I thought, I've had enough. I'm switching this off.
He was attacking you in relation to your experience in the hospital.
He was accusing me of potentially bringing COVID into the workplace because I'd gone on that day when I'd had a little bit of a cough. There were no other symptoms. And I then subsequently found out, and I think it's probably because of so much fear around it, people were scared. And they were all, I was become a pariah. It was, oh, Mike's coming here. And he's, so I was talking about the experience of having had it. They were accusing me of making sort of saying, accusing me of actually saying that I caught it in the workplace. Now, you gosh, there's no way you can tell where you caught it.
Where you got it from, yeah.
Could
But
have,
then,
it
yeah,
could
and
have been
because you didn't
anywhere.
know, you ran
Yeah.
into work, and it's not like you intentionally tried to expose them, you just weren't aware that
Yeah,
you had it at the
so
time. Okay.
in fact, actually, the week before I'd gone in with that little bit of a cough, because I did consider not going in on that day, but my boss at the time had sort of said, oh, somebody else had a little bit of a sniffly nose and stayed at home, and there's one or two like kind of remarks about, oh, he's skipping the day just because he's got a bit of a sniffly nose, there's nothing wrong with him. So you get picked up on that kind of attitude, that kind of, so I was didn't want to be ironically, I didn't want to be treated like that. Yet it was, honestly, it was horrible. I'd already got that, as I said, I'd already had that guilt, that survivor guilt, and I really didn't want to go back to work. So I did put in a complaint into work, and what happened after that was it was then subsequently disciplined.
You were disciplined.
I was disciplined. So I put in a complaint against this manager to HR, and I hadn't quite gone back into work at that time, and they were saying, oh yes, we can have some mediation, we're going to try and sort that out. And then the next thing I knew, they said, oh no, actually no, you're under investigation. So I then
After
had to
a
attend.
near-death experience in the
Yeah,
hospital for 8 days, exposed to death, like, you know. And you were disciplined. Ugh, this is okay.
when I eventually did go back to work, and I did manage to keep my job after, even when I appealed against the discipline, I still managed to keep my job. But it was horrible to go back into work, and I really didn't want to go back. The only reason I did go back and continue working was because at that time I still had a mortgage, I still had some loans, I still got a house to run. So it was just not financially possible for me to just give up. So I continued, and until really, a couple of years ago, my father passed away, and then we got, then there was an inheritance come through. So when that inheritance came through, I was able to pay off the mortgage, pay off my loans, got an amount of money in the bank, able to do some work on the house, and it was really about June last year, I put in to go part time. So I really, because I was getting a lot, I was still getting a bit of fatigue as a result of the COVID, the long COVID. I still got, still not as 100% fit. So I thought I'd go part time and try that. And actually, that just made things worse. It was, I just got even more stressed working part time. So it got to into November last year. I went into work one day in the morning and I knew I was going to do this. I knew it was in my head before I'd even got there. I opened my laptop, looked at my emails, switched the laptop off, shut the laptop down, went to the supervisor and said, I don't feel very well, I'm going home. And she said, okay, that's all right. And I never went back. I then, middle of December, I put in a resignation letter. I said, I'm taking early retirement. Thank you very much. Bye bye. Because I felt I was never able to, they wouldn't allow me to talk about the experience at work. It was like a, because it was like, a, oh, we're all really traumatized because of what happened to you. They didn't want to hear it. It was a sort of supervision and that sort of thing. I tried to raise it in supervision. So I worked in drugs and alcohol work and I just got shut down. They were saying, oh, people were still upset with you over what happened. You don't want to bring that up again.
I
Everybody,
cannot wrap my head around this, Martin, the response to you for being
yeah.
sick. I really just unreal. Well, let me ask you this. You mentioned the survivor's guilt, right?
Yeah.
Can you go into a bit more detail about how that showed up for you and perhaps some of the triggers for you?
Yeah, it was certainly a trigger. I have to say, I did have some ideation at that time. It was emotionally, it was very difficult. Some of the survival was the fact that for quite a long while, I didn't have to go. I was only had to go in the office about one day a week and one or 2 days a week, and it was very short, very small. So I didn't have that atmosphere of people around me, with all that kind of that difficult being sent to Coventry. Not really spoken to. So that was, I was able to survive through that. And eventually things started to roll away and people got used to it, used to it. I got used to being back at work, but my heart had gone out of it. My heart had gone out of the work. I loved working with my clients. I loved that side of the work, but the workplace was toxic. Like a lot of workplaces are. Yeah, so the survival stuff was awful. I can remember there was one particular guy who was in the bed opposite me, and we did talk whilst we were there a little bit. He was like looking out for me, and I was looking out for him. His name is Barry, really, really nice guy, and his family kept on ringing him up and worried about him, and they were one thing or another, and he was really distressed. Now, he gradually went downhill, and when I was due to go home, when I was due to leave the hospital, I said to him, "Well, we'll keep in touch, Barry." And I spoke to his wife as well because he was CPAP'd up, one thing or another. And the next day, when I got home, the next morning, his wife phoned me and told me he died.
Oh, so
And it's
sad.
it absolutely devastated me because I built up quite a little friendship with him in there, and I was looking forward to a time when we could. So just feeling a bit now, just talking about it is bringing it back to me. It was so that was a so that was like a bereavement, really. It took me a long time to cope with that. So I didn't, I spoke to his wife a couple of times, and we kind of lost contact, unfortunately. But there was that kind of thing. So I think. So there was all of that, and the only way I could try and manage it was to write about it. I constantly thought about it, write stuff down about it, recall it, go through the experience. I mean, I had a what I thought at the time, and maybe it was a near-death experience. I can remember you lose track of days when you're in there because it's like day and night, like all the same. I can remember sort of like feeling like time had stood still. And like everything mattered, and nothing mattered at the same time. And it was almost as if I was asking the maker to sort of say, look, am I allowed to continue? I don't feel I'm done with my life yet. I've got other things I want to do, you know. And it was a kind of surreal experience of almost like watching outside of time and waiting for a decision to be made. And then knowing the decision had been made, but not knowing what the outcome was. I think that was something, because they gave me an experimental drug called remdesivir, I think it's called. And I think it caused me to hallucinate. So I was having some really weird experiences. The sounds of the beeping in the hospital, I came to the conclusion that out of that, I created a new form of music. And I was got really excited, and I was going to tell, and I told my friend the next day, I said, I just discovered this. I'm going to be the new Brian Eno. You know, we're going to be really famous. You know, it was delusion. And the lights, you know, I could see faces in the lights. And my voice that next morning was rather strange. My wife phoned me up, and they thought I had a stroke because I wasn't able to speak properly. But I think it was just the side effects, because they obviously took me up and did a scan, brain scan, all that business, and everything came back okay. Unfortunately, I was okay. But my family were, the nurses were saying, oh, we think he might have had a stroke, because my speech was slurred and I was talking about some strange things.
So you mentioned that you journaled. Could I
Yeah.
say journaled? You journaled a lot to deal with, the feelings that you had. Would you say that process is what helped you really get back to you, or are you back to you?
I'd say, yeah, it did help me to get back to who I am. The biggest thing of, I guess, coming to terms with stuff was actually taking the retirement. And I've just even been reflecting on that today, in terms of, I mean, I'd always, all the way through my life, I kind of struggled a bit with communication with people. And then it was last year, or maybe the year before, I've got my grandson. My eldest grandson is autistic, and he doesn't speak. He is selective mute. He doesn't speak, and he doesn't pay much attention. So I wanted to learn a bit about that. So I did a course on autism, and then at the end of it, I thought, that's me. And it made sense going through that course all the way through my life, where I'd struggled with communicating with people and getting picked on when I was at school, and even struggling in the workplace. That actually that I was just a little bit different, you know, a little bit neurodiverse. And once I realized that, I really come to terms with it, and I accept it. I've been, not been diagnosed, and I don't need a diagnosis. I just know it to be true. And one of those things is, when we become aware of these things, you can then make adjustments and then understand, oh, right, okay, Mark, you know, shut up, don't tell that joke. I'm one of those people that you know, in meetings, I would always be searching for the pun, you know, in conversations. And I still do it now. Friends of mine do it as well. So I just started to just to, well, no, don't say it. And I've, you know, I've basically, I guess people found me a bit irritating. So I hold back. So that really, in terms of survival, that revelation was a big one to me. And now, having retired, I'm not doing nothing. I'm sorry, podcasting, but I'm a mindfulness. I do a mindfulness practitioner, so I do a bit of mindfulness in the community, and Life Chapters Wellbeing Service. So I'm really active in terms of well-being in the community, and that's partly why I do the podcast as well, because the podcast Peace Unplugged is about people's well-being. I'm fascinated by people. And what makes them tick, and what makes them work, and what their thoughts are. So that's become a real good motivation to continue.
That's good. What is interesting, and one of the reasons why I wanted to have this conversation with you, is a lot of people do not align COVID, the pandemic, with trauma, right? And I think the masses were traumatized by how things played out, how long we were on lockdown, particularly in England. We were in lockdown for quite some time. I think we were one of the countries that were locked down the longest. And a lot of people came out of the pandemic unaware that they were operating from a place of trauma, which is interesting. I mean, yeah, you had a close death experience, so you literally had to survive. But all of us came out of that experience slightly different. And I don't think that there is a huge social awareness of that. I think we just went on with it, right? In some respects, I can understand the hysteria created at your job about the situation, right? Because there was a lot of fear mongering. People really didn't have a lot of information. And I actually stopped watching the news because of how things were being delivered. It created a lot of fear. And yes, we have a right to be fearful. This was a life-threatening event. However, I also think mixed with a bit of ignorance because of how things were presented to us, it created this dynamic where people were misinformed but quite vocal about their ideals, which I think left this gap of consideration for others and left a lot of people traumatized. And often what I talk about is, we end up in survival mode often. So you literally were in two levels of survival mode. You literally were fighting for your life, but then you had to come back and fight, essentially fight your workplace for, for justice, essentially, right? That is trauma, listeners. Like, it's not always about assaults and sexual trauma or abuse. You essentially say it, Martin, I was in a toxic workplace. How many of us have experienced that? And how are we dealing with the ramifications or the residual impact of that?
Yeah, and it's I agree with you, Letitia, about I try to have an understanding of other people. It's very, very tempting to want to go on onto the blame. You did this to me, blah, blah. This is how I've, getting all into that. I get away from that. I'm an advocate of emotional intelligence. I'm an advocate of communicating in an adult way, looking to understand. And so I had some empathy for those people, the way they felt, because they didn't have my experience. And they were scared. And when we're scared, when we're frightened, when we're up against something that we don't understand and is not familiar, then we tend to go into, we will then, people will then either fight or flight. They're going to be aggressive or they're going to run away. And that's a real life, true life experience. So that a lot of the work I'm trying to do now is around that. And I say work in my locality, it's the Birchington Health and Wellbeing Group. One of the things we're doing, and this has come out a lot as a result of COVID, is that there's lots of people that are isolated. I live in an area where there's a lot of retired people, and many of them are on their own. They're isolated. Some of them don't speak to anybody. And that is a real trauma. That's really bad for mental health if we don't communicate. So we're trying to work out ways how we can actually get people together. And of course, it's not just a case of go, oh, we've got a meeting coming up here, got a group we can come to. People don't always come because actually they're fearful of it. They're fearful. You almost become comfortable with the discomfort because it's what you know.
It's what you know. It's almost like, and I talk about this when I share my story, you get used to being in a certain state, and whether it's chaotic or not, it's what's comfortable. One of the things that I had to learn through my traumatic event is how to be at peace, to be calm, not to be in a fight and flight situation. And I can recognize that throughout my life, when I was, because I gotten so used to the chaos, I was either bored or felt completely out of place. Because, like, wait a minute, why am I not in survival? Like, why am I not needing to figure out how to survive this situation? Something has to be wrong with this situation because I'm used to fight and flight. I'm used to this state of being. And if I'm not in it, who am I really? But it's not a conscious reconciliation. It's subconscious because our subconscious mind tries to keep us safe, and it creates a status quo no matter how chaotic that state is, right? It fights against us when we try to go against the status quo, even when it is in our best interest.
It's that again, it's that loss of identity. I experienced that loss of identity. I experienced actually utter disbelief of what was happening. And it was that there were times I had times when I thought actually perhaps I have died. You know, and perhaps I'm in some parallel universe somewhere because everything seemed so outrageous. It was really difficult to come to terms with. I think that's what we do, and I think there is that thing about we're talking about survival. I think in some cases when, like you said, there's like an auto survival thing. It just very briefly, I mean, it was many, many years ago. We lost a child. Stillborn child, and I can remember that the initial trauma of that, and then suddenly going back to work a week later as if nothing had happened, and that felt really strange. And I had some guilt about that, feeling that way, thinking, oh, you know, I should be. And then I realized that it was about 3 or 4 months later, one day at the workplace, I just had a panic, massive panic attack. It was as if someone set a bomb off outside. I think what had happened was I'd gone into auto survival mode, and then once that had gone through, then all of a sudden all those feelings all suddenly came back. So it was almost like re-traumatizing, you know, and I believe that's what happens. Sometimes that's what happens. We go into this situation where we become automatons. We just carry on doing, you get up, you go to work, you clean your teeth, you eat your dinner. And almost like it as if nothing has ever happened. And then
And
once
for
that.
most people, they describe survival mode as autopilot. I was literally an autopilot. I did what I had to do, but there was no oomph behind it. There was no, someone even said there was even no executive decisions being made. I was just existing. And for some, that is a state that lasts for years
Yeah, I
without the
agree.
tools to break the cycle.
Yeah, and I think it took a few sessions of counselling about, as when I originally said to you that we were still saying, I'll talk about traumatic experience. I talked about the COVID. There's been other things that have happened in my life, like lots of people have, but it actually is then going in and getting, I can remember one particular session, sand therapy. So it's the bringing out a sandbox and getting all important, sitting on the floor and getting all the toys out. Right, identify which toy represents you, which one represents this person, that person, and then a revelation of actually I was isolating myself away from everybody. It was there was me and there was everybody else, and they were all on the other side. Again, it was a really upsetting thing to see. But it was also a revelation because it gave me an understanding of how I was behaving and what I needed to
Awareness.
adjust.
Awareness is, I liken it to a lighthouse, and I know the listeners have heard me say this 100 times. Awareness is the biggest gift because it lightens a dark room. You know what I mean? It really, it's like, ah, oh, I finally have an answer.
And it's never, It's you get it, then but then you discover something else you don't know, and that's part of what living's about. It's all about part of what our life's all about. There's always a that if we can always have a bit of a motivation about where we're going in our lives, then that's worth being alive for. If you start to lose motivation, if you start to lose that kind of that love of life, then that's I think that's where people really get seriously unwell. And to a certain extent, I think I probably experienced a bit of that as well, because I was beginning to think, you know, you start the scary things is that when the inner mind says, "What's the point?" And it's when I've had those moments, as I had the end of last year, I just thought, actually, that this is I need to get out of this job. I needed to get away from it. Move away, and since doing it, I'm able to see it in a much bigger light now, and realizing that actually I was far more stressed in that work than I was aware of at the time, despite everybody telling me that I was really stressed, and a friend of mine telling me for 10, 16 years I've worked in that, and the last 10 of them, this real close friend of mine was saying to me, "What are we going to do, Martin, to get you out of this job and get you into something else?" And I go, "No, it's all right. It's okay. I like my job. I like what I do. Yeah, things are a bit stressful, but it is what it is." Now, looking back on it, I thought, crikey, he was so right. Because I was making myself, if I'd have carried on doing that job, I'd be surprised. I'm 61 now. I don't think I would have made retirement, you know, proper retirement age. I think I probably would
That's
have
for the
killed
level of
over.
stress and the toxicity that you were dealing with.
Yeah. So it was getting away from it. And now it's just the freedom I feel now to. To be myself and not be afraid to be myself, and to have the confidence to talk to people, to run my own podcast, to go searching for guests, meeting people, and just loving it without somebody, the criticism of somebody else, or maybe the criticism of my self-criticism kicking in and saying, "Oh, you can't do that. You're just no good. It won't work. It won't happen." Now I just think actually, whether it works or whether it doesn't matter.
It doesn't.
What
It's just book.
matters is that is I enjoy doing
Yes. And you can
it.
figure it out as you go, you know what I mean? Without any massive pressure. I have massively enjoyed this conversation, Martin. How can people find you online?
Okay. So there's I'm on Facebook, and I use a kind of a stage name because I'm a musician as well. So it's Marty Bone Idol. That's Boneidol. Little play on words there because I play the trombone in a ska band. I've got my podcast is called Peace Unplugged. It comes up on all the major places like Apple and Spotify. It's hosted on Podbean. And for lots of people, I've worked out a way that if people have got Alexa, if you use Alexa, and you can download the Alexa app to your phone as well. Us just ask Alexa, play podcast Peace Unplugged, then it comes up with the first episode, and then you can ask and then go next, and it will play through them. So that's a nice way for people, because there's one particular guy I'm involved with. He's blind, and he was saying to me, "How do I get into this podcast?" So I worked that out, and he loves that. He's able to do that. Ask Alexa, and he's able to listen to the podcasts.
That's pretty
So.
cool. Yeah, so Martin, one key takeaway that you want to leave with the guest, I mean with the audience today.
Okay, never give up. Through the storms you get through your life, just keep on keeping at it. Even in the depths of depression, which I've been in on several occasions, sometimes I call it's a bit like I call it getting on the bus. You can't get off the bus until you get to your destination. So it needs a lot of patience. You've got to kind of delve into a sense of patience about what's happening and what's going on, and seek help, ask for help, talk to people, find people you can trust to speak to. It's really, really important, because if we don't do that, we then just isolate, and then all the mental health issues will kick in, which can be really nasty. So I say, yeah, just don't give up.
Don't give up, listeners. Thank you so much, Martin, for your time. Thank you, listeners, for
Thank you.
tuning in once again. And please remember, you were not built to break, but you damn sure were not just built to survive. Disrupt the cycle, reclaim your life, and thrive on your own terms. I'll see you next week.